Persuasion is the story of a woman who gives up a great love and then finds him again. Written by Jane Austen, it's now the subject of a Netflix adaptation starring Dakota Johnson. The film tries to be of its own time and also contemporary, with Austen characters talking about self-care and being single and thriving. I'm Linda Holmes, and today we're talking about the new adaptation of Persuasion on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Joining us today is Margaret H. Willison. She is one half of the Two Bossy Dames newsletter and one third of the Appointment Television podcast. Welcome back, Margaret.
Hi, Linda. Thanks for having me.
And also joining us is film and culture critic Kate Young. Welcome back, Kate.
Hi, delighted to be here.
I'm so happy to have the two of you here. So the story of Persuasion is basically that Anne Elliot, played here by Dakota Johnson, is single in her late 20s, 8 years after breaking off her engagement to the dashing Captain Frederick Wentworth, played by Cosmo Jarvis. She had loved him very much, but she had been persuaded, you see, that he didn't have enough prospects, that she should marry him. So he went off to sea, and they haven't seen each other since. Anne's family has now fallen on hard financial times and is forced to lease out their home. And through that process, Anne runs into Frederick again, and they renew their acquaintance. Meanwhile, she's also dealing with the sudden appearance of her dashing cousin and the presumed heir to her father's dwindling estate. He's played by Henry Golding. The film is now streaming on Netflix. Kate, I'm going to start with you. I have been told that you are not a person who has read Persuasion, so I'm curious how you felt about the movie.
I have not read Persuasion. I am famously a noted Austen contrarian. I have found much more success with contemporary adaptations than straight ones. For me personally, I was, after the response to the trailer, I was determined to love this movie just to be on the other side of the discourse. And I do love Dakota Johnson, and I will watch anything that she's in, but I do have to say that, frankly, this movie is just fine. Like, it does not offend me in any way, but it certainly does not ignite me either. I didn't think that there was any real sense of heat or passion or romance. It's kind of what I call, like, a Sunday afternoon movie. It's, you know, something that's lightly boring enough that you don't have to pay attention, and then you come away from it feeling generally pleasant about it. But there's really not a ton to recommend it, unfortunately. It just kind of is.
I have to say, Kate, relative to some of the other reviews that it has received, they're going to put all of that in the next advertisement. They're going to put, does not offend me in any way, Kate Young. Margaret, you are an Austenite.
Yeah.
I am curious, what did you think of this adaptation of Persuasion?
You know, what I will say is that it left me much less violently angry than I was expecting it to. And I think my takeaway is not entirely dissimilar to Kate's. I was so excited that she hadn't read the book and so excited to have somebody from outside who could assess it, because I was trying to speculate. I was like, would any of the emotional arcs here make even the remotest amount of compelling sense, given the changes they've made to all of these characters and the way that everyone is reacting? And the answer is no. But also, much like Kate, my standard for like a nice Sunday afternoon rom-com, like, most of those emotional arcs don't make sense. It's not compelling, but it's pretty.
See, I think it's not pretty. I think it looks terrible. I think it's
what... Oh, I should say, I think the cast is pretty.
The cast is very pretty. But this is actually one of my beefs, is that I think it looks lousy. I think it looks muddy.
Yeah.
I think the colors of both the exteriors and the interiors are sort of bleh in this way that I maybe is supposed to feel English. I don't know.
I'm just going to say that I feel like muddy is maybe like just a good way to describe the overall intentions of this project. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know what it wanted to be. I don't think it achieved what it wanted to be. And it did take a story that I think is kind of perfect, one of my favorite books of all time, and produce from it something I'm never going to watch again.
Yeah. I want to play, actually, Margaret, you were kind enough to bring a clip that is one of the clips that I also really noticed. I want to play this little clip, then we'll talk about what I think this clip says about what they were going for.
Great.
Now I'm single and thriving. I spend my time drinking fine wines, enjoying warm baths, and lying face down on my bed.
So you can tell two things from that. First of all, it has this little doop, 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 doop music, which puts a kind of wacky feel to her emotional state at the beginning of the story, Whereas, although I also have not read the book, my understanding is that her emotional state is meant to be more genuinely sad and sort of having experienced a loss that has caused her to learn.
Yeah, this is nothing like Anne Elliot, the character. Like, and I'm just going to zoom out. I feel like with your 19th century literature girlies, you have your Bronte girlies and you have your Austen girlies. And there's some overlap. There's some commingling. And I think Bronte is an author who writes a lot about what is it like to have incredibly strong feelings and have no way to hide them. Austen is approaching things very differently. And I think Anne Elliot in the book is one of the best examples of this approach, which is, what is it like if you have incredibly strong feelings, but you are capable of hiding them? Mm-hmm. You are capable of subduing them and existing in this polite society, meeting society's expectations of you. And like, what are the moral choices you need to make as that kind of person?
Right.
So as someone who identifies with that question a lot, I think that the struggle you see with Anne generally is you see her having these immense feelings and mostly being incredibly relieved that no one around her can perceive them.
Yeah.
I'm going to pull another clip that is from the dinner party.
Anyone between the ages of 18 and 80 may have me for the asking. Almost anyone.
Charles wanted to marry me first.
So that's Anne there, stating baldly at a dinner table full of her in-laws and her, like, low-key narcissist sister, that her brother-in-law wanted to marry her first before she married her little sister. That's a plot point from the book, and it is a plot point that is sort of valuable for you as the reader to know to get a sense of everyone's arrangement. But, like, a person who would do that at a dinner is a person I want nowhere near me ever.
Yeah. And I think with this, it frustrates me because I feel like the trailer that so incensed everyone gave me a glimpse into a story that I actually was interested in seeing. But I also feel like the film does not pay off on the story that it told me it was telling, even if it is in fact different from the original material. And it frustrated me because I felt like there are so many characters that are in this story and so many of them that are interconnected in different ways, but I didn't get the sense that any of them mattered in any real way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, this is one of the reasons I wanted to play that little Single and Thriving clip is that I think I understand exactly what they're going for. I'm not saying like that's out of place in Austen. Like, of course it is. They know that that's on purpose. It's meant to be sort of updated. But I think the bits of kind of contemporary dialogue that they decided to add are mostly really boring.
Yes.
Like they have, they're really cliches.
Yes.
At one point, Wentworth says, good talk. Like, they're contemporary, but they're boring. And I think what it made me think of, and Margaret and I have talked about Clueless as a very successful Austen adaptation. A lot of Austen is not dialogue. It's the reader being addressed. A lot of that is very stylized. And so you can update it. But the thing about Clueless is all of that dialogue, again, is really stylized. It lives in this really exaggerated place. Whereas in this, it's just, I mean, what is interesting about updating it and having a woman say, how do I prioritize self-care? Like, just because it's contemporary doesn't make it interesting. Do you know what I mean, Margaret? You do.
That is exactly the point that I wanted to make about it. And the clip that I had pulled was from the same sister, from her little sister, who's like kind of a hypochondriac. And a scene where she's explaining that she can't stay at home with her kids because she's too much of an empath.
Please understand, the thing about me is I am an empath. I'm actually the least equipped to be with my children when they're suffering because I feel it so deeply.
And for me, the thing that's maddening is like the magic trick of reading Austen as a contemporary person reading a 19th century story is you read it and you read the dialogue that a 19th century person would say and you think in your head, oh my God, this is like the kind of person who'd be like, you want to make sure to like put your mask on before you put on anyone else's oxygen mask, you know? You make that transition. I just think about that a lot.
It's true. And the other thing I would say about this story, and Margaret, you talked about this being a story that you really love. You know, you'll read, when you read about this book, you read a lot of people talking about this being kind of Austen's most mature or most adult novel because you're dealing with people who are a little bit older. Like
all of 27 years old.
For the time, 27 or 28 was somebody who was really kind of had aged out of the kind of the hot part of the marriage market.
Yeah.
one of the things that I think is sad about this is that you really lose the way in which this is an adult story about a person who made a decision as a young person, has gone off and lived for a number of years, and now regrets that decision and has learned a lot about herself and what she actually wants. You know, you talked about Margaret, you know, having kind of lower standards for Sunday rom-coms. Like, I insist upon having high standards for Sunday afternoon rom-coms as much as I would for anything else. And I feel like the low standard, and it's interesting because the script here is, one of the writers of the script here is Ron Bass, who wrote My Best Friend's Wedding, which I actually think is a really interesting, like,
my all-time favorite rom-com.
Which is incredible.
I want that energy of being willing to kind of examine these stories a little bit more.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I was so bummed that this just kind of plunks it down and just makes it like from the beginning, she's like, does he like me? Does he like me? And then they sort of circle each other surrounded by all this stuff that ripped out of the context of the book and the kind of social rules. That's why the stuff with the Henry Golden character doesn't make any sense, is that it's related. And Margaret, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's related to the same reason why everybody wanted Mary to marry Matthew at the beginning of Downton Abbey. It's sort of this idea that if you marry the heir, you can kind of, the family stays intact in a certain way.
I think they did that on Bridgerton too.
100%. Yeah, it's marrying to preserve the family, and that is something that can work.
Right.
But because this film doesn't have any interest in those kind of social structure things, because it's focused on her individuality, right?
Right.
It's like they've sacrificed the idea that she feels like a cog in order to get to this, I feel like Bridget Jones. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, for a very un-Bridget main character. I think what's actually interesting is the book, Anne doesn't even rate enough with her family to be a cog.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They want the heir to marry the oldest sister.
Right.
And if he marries Anne, yeah, like their fortune's going to stay intact, their position's going to stay the same, but probably her dad and her older sister will be almost as mad as if he married her lady's maid, which is functionally Miranda. What he does do.
Yeah.
And this is the thing that I feel like a lot of people don't understand about 19th century marriage plots. Yes, it's a love story, but it is also the only method of self-determination most well-born women were given.
Yeah.
It's like, who do you marry? So you're not just choosing like, oh, which of these boys is cutest? You're like, what kind of life do I want to lead? What kind of person am I going to be? And so it's very freighted to be given Anne this choice between like, well, you can step into the shoes of your mother and redeem the estate that you grew up on and be the kind of noble you were always raised to be and establish your family honor that your father's completely destroyed. Or you can step away from all of that and make a life for yourself with people whose values actually align with yours.
Yeah, and I don't think you get that from this movie at all.
No,
I think what you get in terms of the choice that she made in terms of being persuaded was not that she was persuaded into that choice that you just talked about,
right?
But that she was persuaded he's not good enough. He doesn't have enough going for him. He's not going to have enough money, which is related-ish, but it's different. It's not the same thing. I do want to go back, Kate, to something that you said, which is that you've had better luck with contemporary adaptations of this kind of literature. Mm-hmm. Tell me about your fondness for more contemporary adaptations.
I think part of it, honestly, is that I often don't realize that they are adaptations until later. I am the world's biggest Bridget Jones fan. It was actually only after seeing this film that I realized that it is essentially the plot of the second Bridget Jones movie.
Yeah.
But even with that, like, that is until the third film had come out. The second one was my favorite. And a lot of it does have to do with how much of that film is about kind of actively pining for Mr. Darcy. And, like, you really do get a sense that she's desperately in love with him, but they tried, it didn't work out, and it just doesn't quite work for them. And, like, you know, like, there's so much more yearning. And I think to me, that's always the part of romances that I really gravitate towards. Like, I want to see how much you want your partner. And I feel like this film just kind of doesn't really have that. Even in the big final kiss, I mean, it's just sexless. Like, they have no chemistry. And I think, ironically, the best scene, or the scene in which I felt most like they were actually former lovers, is the scene towards the middle of the film where they're on the beach.
There's no one quite like you. And it's clear to me that I want you in my life. No matter what form that takes, bury the past, and I suppose what I'm getting at is I would like to be friends.
And that was the only time in the film where I felt like, oh, there is actual longing here. Like, they miss each other. They love each other. She's devastated to hear him say, like, this will be the end of it. And we'll just, like, be in each other's lives and circle each other in our orbit. And that was the only time that I felt like, oh, I get it. Perhaps it is just because, obviously, we've kind of decided that 27 is not that old anymore. But she just felt very flighty and young to me. It didn't feel, she, like, there's the early scenes where she's, like, thrown herself on her bed and she's whining about how she loves him. And I'm just like, I mean, sure, I guess.
Yeah, she's a very emotionally immature character as presented in this film. She's messy. Mm-hmm. And not in any kind of interesting, challenging way that they go anywhere with. It's not like, what is it like to be a messy woman in a society that doesn't really make space for that?
Right.
Because the plot is still shaped like she's the Anne Elliot from the book, who's very considerate of other people, never an imposition, really great at being of service to others, and very, very emotionally reserved and contained. And I don't have any understanding of what the emotional connections between her and anyone else are supposed to be or where they're coming from, because they've made all these changes, but they haven't actually followed through with them. They made them in a boring, sloppy kind of way, and you're just left with question mark.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing too, Margaret, is although, as I said, I've not read the book, what I typically do when I have seen a film like this is I will sort of consult the book and kind of take a look at some sections to see like how they differ. Austin prose kind of has a reserve to it and a remove.
Yeah,
from it.
Which I love.
And when you go through that prose and then you hit the letter that he writes her and you read the letter, it is.
Oh, boy, the letter.
It knocks the wind out of you because you've been reading this kind of very rationalizing, very like calming. And then you get this like whoof of this letter, which is super romantic. And to me, the fact that in this film, she turns and reads the letter to the audience is unforgivable.
Yes.
Because your love has not lasted as long as mine. I have loved no one but you. And I don't think I ever will.
It is supposed to be private and secret.
Agree.
Okay, that was one of my favorite parts.
Was it really?
Yes.
That is so interesting to me because I wanted it to be private and secret and therefore sexy in a way that it's not to me when she seems like she's telling it to you.
For me, it was, again, one of the few points in the film where I felt the actual longing on screen. I know a lot of people disagree, but I truly feel like that Dakota Johnson is a very strong actress and I really enjoy watching her on screen. The devastation in her face in that scene really worked for me. And I think perhaps it's just because we've already been kind of conditioned to expect her to address us directly. It didn't read as anything, you know, untoward at that point because this is near the end of the film. But when she reads this letter and then she goes dashing off to Wentworth, like that was one of the only times in the film where I really felt like I understand the love that's happening. I understand the emotion that's happening. Throughout most of the movie, she's saying that she loves him and she misses him, but it's just kind of placed there as opposed to examined in any real way. And that was one of the few moments that felt like it was actually engaging with what her feelings were.
I agree with that. I think relative to the rest of the presentation of that love story, that part certainly makes you feel it. It is a great
letter.
It's a beautiful letter.
It's a great letter. And it is in the same way. It is still kind of an outburst of emotion, particularly with him. You really haven't had any opportunity to see him show emotion in the film. So I do agree with you that scene is effective. I just felt like I would have done it differently.
Contrary to Kate, Kate was like, well, I'd been conditioned to accept her speaking to the camera. Meanwhile, I'm furious from the outset that she's doing that because the like essential quality of Anne Elliot is that she's immensely lonely, right? Like that's why Wentworth has so much meaning. Mm-hmm. She says that he's the only person who's ever really seen her. And so for her to have this idea of communion with an audience is actually kind of like you're undermining what makes the character so strong is how she is able to manifest her values, even though she has no one around her who shares them.
Yeah.
It is like a solo act of self-realization. And if you give her this audience, if you give her this external audience who she can feel like she's in amity with, it's not the only adaptation that does this. The 2007 BBC adaptation also has her talking to and interacting with the camera. And I'm like, no, get it out of here.
I mean, the funny thing is, I think it can be done with characters who are lonely. Fleabag is lonely. Mm-hmm. And I think it works very well in that situation to almost underscore her isolation, that she's talking to the camera because she can't talk to anyone else. There's something about like her comfort with her own feelings.
Yes.
That doesn't feel like it's true to who this character is. But yeah, I also think the more it's done, the more that direct address to the camera just makes it feel like
you're watching Fleabag, but someone wrote it worse.
Well, yeah.
Actually, now that you have explained it, Margaret, it still does not bother me, but I understand the objection to it now, because it does make me think of Fleabag when she has parted ways with the hot priest and she leaves the bus station and tells the camera not to follow her.
Right.
That is signifying her moment of growth.
Right.
And I think that the way that Persuasion handles it, she never actually gets to that point. And so she's just kind of like bantering with these, you know, imaginary friends. But if she has these imaginary friends, then like, why is she so lonely? Yeah.
Totally.
I want to touch on one other thing real quick before we go, which is there was some attention when this film was first announced and when the trailer came out to the fact that it is sort of, I guess, what they would consider to be colorblind casting, in the sense that you do have Black actors, you have Henry Golding, it's not entirely white actors. I don't know what your reaction to that was, the two of you. My reaction to that was essentially like, this is great from a hiring perspective. I want more people to get more jobs. But it certainly doesn't engage with that in any way. Yeah. So like, it's not doing anything story-wise, but I am always happy when more people can get hired. I don't know. Kate, what do you think?
There is a point in the film early on where Lady Russell, who is played by a Black actress, says something to the effect of, you know, your mother and I were best friends. And I immediately had the thought of, best friends are made. And you're right that they never engage with that. And there are a handful of other Black characters in the film as well. And I had the general sense of, okay, these people are wealthy, they're in England. Where is that wealth coming from? Because the likelihood that some of it is from slavery is pretty high.
Yeah, pretty much 100%.
So
yeah, I don't think the characters are written in the film to be Black in any meaningful way.
Yeah.
It's almost like when I watched the first season of Bridgerton and it was like, are these people Black? Like, do they, like the actors are. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. I mean, I have a hard time sorting this one out because I mean, it's colorblind in the true like 90s, like we don't see color.
Yeah,
in a sense.
Exactly.
Like,
that's what it is.
Like 100%.
That's what it is.
What's interesting is they don't go like full Brandy Cinderella where it's like, yeah, we're going to have Whoopi Goldberg as the mom, Victor Garber is going to be the dad, and we're going to have a hot Filipino guy as the prince, Paolo Montalban. Cool, right? In this, it's like, well, if we're going to have a Black husband, we're going to have a white mother, and we're going to have biracial kids. So like, yeah, that much not colorblind, otherwise completely colorblind. And on the one hand, I like the idea of like, let's just get the actors who really spark to the role for us, and let's not put race as a consideration. But then if you're stepping into this historical time period where like, there's never been a time where we didn't see color, at least in like Western society,
right.
Like, and if you're not doing anything to acknowledge that,
yeah,
you're not creating a world I can step into and find coherent.
Right.
It reminds me of a very short-lived series that I loved very dearly, the Shondaland show, Still Star-Crossed, which was a retelling of Romeo and Juliet. It was after the events of the story. And that was a show that cast many of its characters diversely, but actually engaged with the racial implications of that at that time. And it's still the only property I've seen that has managed to do that well. And I think with other period dramas that have started casting more diversely, the frustration that I feel is that it effectively takes me out of the narrative, because all I'm thinking about is how these people would actually relate to each other. I mean,
that
world.
It ultimately, for me, all comes back to the fundamental question of like, if you really want to do the thing that I was talking about, which is give more roles to more people and make opportunity more shared, but not just among actors, but also among creators, like maybe don't just keep doing Austin adaptations, particularly in period Austin adaptations where you don't really have an idea of why you're doing it.
Right.
Like maybe just do something else.
Yeah.
I think the struggle with a lot of these films too, is that they heard the complaints that, you know, people of color existed back then, but instead of actually telling the stories of those people, they just kind of replace the white people with them. And it's like, that's not quite what we asked for.
It's true. You know, I don't want to entirely discourage that, because I think that actors of color should be able to act in pieces that are just like light, mm-hmm. right? Where they're like, I don't have to engage with how the history of slavery interacts with the corset I'm wearing. I can just be the pretty girl in the corset dress today, right? Like, I want actors of color to have that much access. But it presents an incoherent world, and there has to be something done narratively to support or address
to,
that.
To explain it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we do want to know what you think about Persuasion. You can find us at facebook.com/PCHH and on Twitter at PCHH. That brings us to the end of our show. Margaret H. Willis and Kate Young, thanks to both of you for being here. This was so much fun.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
One last thing before we go. We are going to be talking about The Wire, and we want to know your questions about the series. What should we talk about? Email us a voice memo with your question about The Wire to pchh@npr.org. Again, email us a voice memo with your question to pchh@npr.org. And of course, thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. This episode was produced by Candace Lim and edited by Jessica Reedy. Hello Come In provides the music you are listening to right now. I'm Linda Holmes, and we will see you all tomorrow when we will be talking about the new Jordan Peele film, Nope.